Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. 9 years ago, Philip Adams needed an English journalist to report the crazy politics of the UK. Brexit had just been voted, Theresa May was Prime Minister. Someone with sharp eyes and a slashing style was needed to make sense of it all. The man Philip chose became, in record time, an indispensable presence on Late Night Live. He's still with us. Indeed, for the very first time, he's sitting opposite me in the Sydney studio. Ian Dunt, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much. This is extremely strange. It feels much more meat space than usual.
Much more what space?
Meat space. It's all very physically real.
You like the whole of the globe between us, do you, to feel...
I mean, I've always felt very comfortable when separated by half a planet. This just seems like extremely intimate.
Well, things have turned nasty. Look, Ian, I wonder whether Philip and the ABC paid due attention to your CV when they first engaged you. I've just been digging around a bit. Part of your childhood in Chile, please explain.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, I was very young, but that's... Spanish is my first language because I was in Chile when I was sort of first growing up, really. So my dad went out there for work. I'm half Latin American, so it sort of weirdly fit, but it didn't have any connection to the fact that I'm half Latin American. My dad just went out there to work. And when I was very young, I was in Chile.
And how old were you when you got back to the safe haven of the United Kingdom?
6 years old or so.
6 years old, right. While you were still a student at the London School of Journalism, you seemed to already be at work in the trade. I was wondering if you could tell us what the job was and the name of the publication.
Oh, no, I know what you're doing. I see what's happening here. This is just basically like this is a trap.
It's not a trap. It is just a little bit of double checking, which the ABC appeared not to have done 9 years ago.
I mean, so some of my first work was for a magazine called The Erotic Review, which I think you're probably referring to.
I am. You've got me there.
Yeah. Okay. So, which is a sort of old school, filthy, kind of Victorian London literary smart magazine, which was, they were the first people to ever commission me, actually. In fact, they were actually the first people to ever pay me for my journalism.
And therefore, there's a warm place in your heart.
Yes, indeed. They used to throw, really quite wonderful parties. But they represented a kind of, I used to think it was quite a sort of thing to believe in, really, because it was sort of the anti-porn. You know, as porn took over the world, this was a much sort of nicer view of things, that it was quite literate and, you know, intelligent and all of that sort of thing. But of course it died because you can't, you know, that's just not the way, that's not the way that things go anymore.
And when it died, you went to politics.co.uk. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, the first work I sort of got doing sort of reporting was for Pink News, which is a gay news website, in a time that was very different for that sort of issue. And eventually sort of became managing editor of that, which really meant nothing. It basically just meant, you know, when the editor was away, they trusted you to run the thing. And then I went off to be an intern at politics.co.uk and was there for years, for about 15 years. And I think at the end when I talk to sort of young journalists now, one of the things like I recommend is to try and find a pond that's small enough that you can really screw things up without there being terrible consequences. And that's what it was. You could just make errors, make mistakes, really embarrassing, shameful mistakes. And now one of the things I learned from that was you just sort of think, before you press publish, before you send the email, before anything becomes public, remember how you felt when you made those mistakes that sense of like your soul crumpling on the underside of your rib cage. And then imagine like your worst enemy, the person that wants to do you the most damage and has the greatest intellectual and empirical abilities, is there tearing apart every sentence of what you're about to write. So now go through that embarrassment here in private without before you have to go through it in public. I think that's a really useful process to have taken on board in an early part of your career. Shame and humiliation, hugely, hugely advantageous. I
think. Hugely, hugely advantageous. But along the way, you developed what might be called a style. Now, look, I just took this at random from something you wrote last year. Wherever you look, bastards. Bastards making the running. Bastards in their moment of triumph, in their pomp. The main lesson a child will learn today is that only the most cruel, the most ignorant, the most mean-spirited succeed. Where did you learn such rhetoric?
Okay, I don't... We're just a combination of all of our influences, aren't we, really? And so there's a little bit of... there's quite a lot of comics writers in there. Like reading comics really helps, I think, as a political journalist. Something that, that feels really dynamic and urgent and is scared of boring you. There's some Hunter S. Thompson in there if we're being completely, you know, realistic about where we're at. There's like, and then hopefully just that sort of like really outraged inner voice in you that, that will always be a little bit naive. You know what I mean? That can't be become fully cynical. That will just be genuinely upset by the state of the world and the state of the people who manage to succeed in it. And to cultivate that voice and not lose contact with it, to not ever become so jaded that you stop believing that things can be any better. And what I often see from, you know, lots of my colleagues is it's when journalistic skepticism sort of degrades into cynicism. And that only helps the bastards, I think, because then you refuse to expect a higher standard from people.
Is one of the real challenges of journalism not to get used to it?
Yeah. That's so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that must be the case. And yet it's so difficult. You know, because it sounds like a radical thing to say. Why are these bastards always lying to me? It sounds, you know, that's it there. But actually, unless you have a sense of the texture of politicians, or the fact that some of them let themselves down, but you can see that there's still some decency there in them, that some of them are actually genuinely aspiring to do something impressive, that some of them have like an inner disposition that would go towards virtue if the institutional incentives around them weren't pushing them towards the opposite. And some of them are just copper bottom bastards in their heart. Unless you have that sense of texture, you just become part of the populist movement, just part of this thing that just tries to disillusion people of the potential for political change. But in actual fact, politicians are much more complicated than that. And you can see that by virtue of how terrible the ones that are currently in charge are compared to the relatively more benign ones that we had before.
Your list of prime ministers, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer, all duds?
Yes, but okay, but I think this is a good example, right, of where we're at. That's, in fact, that's a perfect representation of what I'm talking about. Theresa May was an unspeakable reactionary and a bore. She was genuinely anti-immigration. She did some appalling things in immigration policy, and she helped to drag our conversation on immigration into really ugly terrain. She was cowardly, and she lied incessantly over Brexit and presided over the dismantlement of the country. But she was a person with genuine convictions. You know, and in certain areas, I mean, you take trans rights, she was really strong on trans rights. You take, like, tackling modern slavery, she was strong on those issues. She actually believed in the things that she believed in. She actually believed in anti-immigration rhetoric. She believed in those arguments. You take Boris Johnson, not a single belief in him, not even a capacity for a single coherent belief. Insofar as he was had any view on immigration, he was probably kind of pro. Insofar as he really had any view on Europe, he was probably kind of pro. He just sort of did things because it would advance his agenda. Just this bottomless cynicism and vacuity in human form. So even on that front, with those two, you see the discrepancy between the materials. And then hopefully by the level of specificity that you bring to bear on their performance, you can say something meaningful about them rather than just this sort of instinctive lashing out against them.
Mm. They had achievements. Rishi Sunak?
It's hard for me to point out anything he did that meant anything at all. I would say this, though. When he lost, he did it with real dignity and decorum. Constitutionally, you know, he stood up and went, I have lost and I celebrate, you know, the victory of my opponent. They shook hands. They were cordial. You know, you look at what happens in Washington, that stuff really matters. That's what your system is based on, having people that will accept a defeat. You look at what happened in the Gordon by-election in Britain last Friday.
Which we'll get to.
Great. Like, when Reform lost, that was not an acknowledgement of defeat. In fact, what Matthew Goodwin, the Reform candidate, came out to say was this has been a stitch-up by Muslim voters organising voting within families. You know, they've betrayed British democracy, really taking on board that Trump lesson. So to be honest, in that context, the thing you most want to hand to Rishi Sunak is how gracious he was in defeat and how much that matters on a basic constitutional level.
It is extraordinarily important, isn't it? The peaceful transfer of power has to be a fundamental of democracy. Hence Mr. Trump's efforts in 2020.
Yes, and what we can only presume will be his upcoming efforts
in the midterms.
Or at least, like, you know, these early signs we see, that you would call it conspiratorial to notice them, if it wasn't for the fact that we have now seen him do precisely this before, and we logically and realistically have to expect him to do exactly the same thing again. So much, it's such a strange position we're in politically at the moment. But I would say the majority of my political attention is on the behaviour of the mainstream right, which, by the way, I'd see in a really acute sense in this country over the last sort of week. Exactly how much is the mainstream right holding the line against these really quite pernicious authoritarian populist tendencies that you see on further to the right? And when you look at the Conservative Party, that's what you see. You know, Rishi Sunak, pernicious, weak, vacuous, without anything to recommend him, but he knew how to hold the line on the things that mattered. You know, you go back in American terms, someone like John McCain. Look at the John McCain versus Obama election compared to anything there is now. That sense of mutual respect, that sense of talking about opponents rather than enemies, someone that I disagree with and we can have a conversation about, rather than someone who is defined in opposition to me in their core, in their DNA, in the basis of who they are. That sense that we can both succeed in politics even when we disagree, rather than it being this sort of zero-sum war of attrition on the basis of values and identity. That part, does the mainstream right hold its position, or does it buckle towards this much more exotic, vicious form of right-wing thought? That's where some of the most important developments in politics happen today.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking, of course, to Ian Dunt. Ian, I'm very interested in the point you've just made about the similarities between the right in Britain and the right in Australia and the temptations that they face. Is it always at heart about immigration and about this sense of preserving our way of life?
I think immigration is the most effective and intuitive and emotional mechanism by which the right can translate all sorts of other policy issues, cost of living, you know, national standing, into a really easily understood narrative of decline and invasion and betrayal. And so because it's so effective, far more effective than anything the left has, you know, whenever the left tries to talk in these terms, it just sounds like abstraction. But when the right tries to talk in these terms using immigration, it sounds like concrete, you know.
We've got the proof here.
We've got the proof. We're in the pub. It stands to reason. Off we go. And so that's where the temptation is. And then you start to look at the corruption. You can have that. Look, you, obviously, I'm about as pro-immigration as it gets, but you can obviously have completely legitimate discussions about immigration. What is it doing to domestic wages? Where is it required for immigration? Does it mean that local employers are not training up their own domestic workforce? Fine, you can have that conversation. But that is not the conversation that they want to have on the populist right. So you look at Pauline Hanson, for instance. So her comments recently on, can you have good Muslims? Now, there was a census... There was a sense of motion against her in the parliament, which may or may not be the correct constitutional approach to take on these sorts of things. But you only had two liberal politicians peel off to stand up against those.
To denounce her,
exactly. To cross the floor and make a movement against her. That's the kind of thing that if I was Australian, I'd be paying very careful attention to. Because what happened to us in Britain was one by one, Conservative MPs not standing up on that point of like, oh, you've gone too far now. You know what I mean? This is not the anti-immigrant stuff that you're doing right now. You're now doing racial politics. You know, you're doing something really venomous and pernicious, something dangerous. And that point, can you see the mainstream right stick to its guns, stick to respectable politics, or does it drift off to those temptations, the constant temptation of this much more colourful and often much more effective form of anti-immigrant rhetoric? If I was Australian, that's exactly the area that I'd be paying very careful attention to.
Are you seeing in the UK what we're seeing here, that the conservative drift to the right is detaching educated, prosperous on the whole, conservatives who were once the centre of the conservative opposition in Australia, or conservative governments in Australia? They won't go there. And therefore, the conservative parties are falling apart, but still being dragged over to the right. It's so extraordinary. I mean, they can watch themselves falling apart, and yet they will not go back towards the centre. They are still being dragged to the right. Is that happening in Britain as well?
Yeah, so you have exactly the same process, which seems odd. I would have thought that we would have a very different process because the electoral system is different. And differences in your electoral system should fundamentally change the incentives. It hasn't worked out that way. So what you've seen happen with the gutting of the Liberal Party here is pretty much exactly what you're seeing with the gutting of the Conservative Party in Britain. And instead, as voters switch in those constituencies to support the Liberal Democrats, so I'm talking about seats like the kind of place that I grew up. I grew up in Winchester. It's the kind of constituency that's never going to vote Labour.
No.
It's too well-to-do. It's fundamentally quite small L liberal in its sensibilities. You know, it doesn't, you know, we're very pro-gay marriage and, you know, it doesn't really want anyone
beautiful
to interfere.
Town.
It is a very beautiful town. Although extremely tedious. They're never going to go Labour. They do want to vote Liberal Democrat, unless something looks a little bit too wacky and far left coming from the Labour Party, in which case they'll probably back the Conservatives. Now, those voters have just fled the Conservatives. And that seats all over the country. The voters are just hemorrhaging votes to their left from basically well-to-do, university-educated people who are fairly fiscally conservative but are socially liberal and don't like it when you sound like a nutter. Just don't like it when everything just seems a bit emotional and millennialist and religious. So they're losing voters on that front, but they just don't care. They only care about the voters they're losing to the right, to the nativist movement, to reform. And the same thing in Labour. Labour is hemorrhaging voters to the Greens, to the Liberal Democrats, to
Plaid Cymru. Because Labour is being dragged to the right as well.
On immigration. And yet they don't care. The voters they lose to the right, they really care about. They call them internally hero voters. That's what they call these guys. Reform voters who could be potentially made to vote Labour. That's how they think of them. And so across the political landscape in Britain, what you see is this utter fixation on voters who might go off to the right and a complete lack of interest in any voter who might drift off to the left.
There was a by-election in Britain the other day, which was supposed to be a moment of triumph for the Farage forces. And it all went terribly wrong. Why?
Yes, it's delicious, isn't it? To be honest, they were fighting a seat which, as much as they try to claim that the will of the people is a whole country populated by people going to work in a factory and complaining about immigrants and having a pint of bitter in the evening, that is not what the country is. And what they find in constituencies around Manchester is, yep, there'll be lots of white working class voters, some of whom are anti-immigration, many of whom are not, and have a far more complex and interesting series of views than they are portrayed to have by the media or by the political class. There are also seats with a very high density Muslim population, very high density university-educated population. Generally speaking, in a constituency in Britain, and I'd be very surprised if it was any different here, the greater degree of diversity you have and the greater degree of university degrees you have, the greater degree you'll get of a left-wing vote or a vote for one of the centre-left parties.
That's the same.
Right. And so suddenly they think that they can have a fight on what they imagine Britain to be, but that is not what Britain is. Certainly not ever, and certainly not around a city like Manchester. Great big urban areas. So they came a cropper, and they came a cropper even though the vote split. So the vote split between Labour and the Greens pretty drastically. Plenty of constituencies that would let you right in through the middle. But there are enough progressive voters that you managed to prevent a reform triumph. And they handled that, as I said, with about as little grace as you might expect of them.
But let's hear just a little of the winner, the Greens candidate, Hannah Spencer.
I didn't grow up wanting to be a politician. I'm a plumber. And 2 weeks ago, during all this, I also qualified as a plasterer. Because even in chaos, even under pressure, I get things done. I am no different to every single person here in this constituency. I work hard. That is what we do. Except things have changed a lot over the last few decades. Because working hard used to get you something. It got you a house, a nice life, holidays. It got you somewhere. But now, working hard, what does that get you? Instead of working for a nice life, we're working to line the pockets of billionaires. We are being bled dry. And I don't think it's extreme or radical to think working hard should get you a nice life.
Well, she's great. She's just really very impressive. You can tell she's a little bit nervous there, but how wouldn't you be? I mean, literally, she's doing a speech about becoming an MP, where she's like, by the way, I'm just really sorry to my customers who I said I'd go down and do the plumbing for next week. So I have to go to Parliament.
Yes, I've got a job in London.
She's just wonderful. And so therefore, the next day, when Keir Starmer, whose decisions really just require more of a psychologist than they do a political analyst to interpret at this point, puts out a statement saying people have voted for division and hatred and no answers, and you just think, like, you can't honestly think that anyone's going to associate that with the voice that you just heard. You know, do you honestly believe that that'll work? But then what drives me nuts about that is that that's never the way that he would talk about reform voters. He would never speak about reform voters in those terms.
He would never say, you are divisive, racist.
He does, but nevertheless, you're voting for. It's always this thing of like, no, let's understand people's legitimate concerns. He talks about Nigel Farage that way, the leadership cast of reform, he'll talk about that way. But the voters know. And so in this case, you just think, like, this is your coalition, man. This is the people that put you in power. Just 18 months ago, the broadest coalition of progressive voters that you can find, from those kind of, you know, real centrist Winchester fiscal conservative types to, you know, the further limits of the Green Party, you know, challenging nuclear power and wanting really firm action on climate change and going on Gaza demos. That's your coalition, really broad. And if you can have monopoly over that, you can win again. But you won't do it if every time someone gets annoyed with your anti-immigration policies, you call them divisive, you know, and wreckers. It just doesn't make any sense. It's ineffective electorally and tactically and morally and in pretty much any other conceivable way there is for him to be ineffective.
Behind the immigration, the politics of immigration in this country is a very strong sense of wanting to preserve our way of life, to be what we have always been. And I wonder, looking at that, whether nostalgia is one of the most poisonous drivers in politics. Nostalgia for the old days.
I thought about that a lot after Brexit. Because it was such, I mean, I remember seeing a vox pop. I mean, God help me if I came to any conclusions on the basis of a vox pop, but nevertheless, with these sort of two older women who just voted Leave, and they asked them why, and they were like, oh, so we can bring Britain back to the good old days. And I just thought, nothing you do in that ballot box is going to make you young again. And I suspect that that's what you want. You know, it doesn't have that power. So what is it that we can do? And about sort of like, a lot of that is then, yes, immigration. And obviously, you know, what is the Donald Trump slogan? It's make America great again. It's essentially, let's go back to the 1950s. In the American terms, that's what they dream of. Britain doesn't dream of the 1950s because it had a horrible 1950s.
Yes. Still particularly grim.
Exactly, yeah. So we don't have the same, you know, it's not like, oh, everyone had two cars and a refrigerator in the 50s. They barely had food. But still that thing of like, you can go back to your youth. You can go back to when things were simpler. And a lot of this stuff is like, you can go back to that really successful Keynesian progressive economic period, 1945 until the late 1970s, when we had the right economic tools, we were aiming for full employment, we controlled the market, we had full regulation of the banks, you know, companies that wanted to put chemicals in our waters. And that sort of appeal, therefore, gives you some indication of the kind of left-wing answer to a lot of this stuff. The things that people are harking back towards is not just that societal homogeneity, it's also having a greater degree of economic control over their lives.
Do the British, sort of behind it all, imagine that they're going down the chute?
Oh, 100%.
That's different from Australia. We don't want to make Australia great again. We don't know what that means. But there's no sense here. I mean, we face challenges, but there's no sense here that we're actually going down the chute. But in Britain, there is.
Yes. That is a huge distinction. And the thing is, the distinction is coloured by the discrepancy in the fundamental sensibilities of both countries, right? Like, I mean, Sydney does not suit me. The reason that Sydney doesn't suit me is I walk around and I just think everyone's beautiful, athletic, the food is lovely, the wine is lovely, the weather is good. I mean, obviously, none of this applies in this studio, obviously. No, but, you know, elsewhere in the city.
Or even in the ABC. But Ian, what you're experiencing is, of course, what we call visitor syndrome. If you lived here, you might have a less glowing view, but...
I'm sure. But it is... You know, I just walk around and just think, if you sit around in Sydney for a while, you just think, naturally, everything's going to be okay. And I just don't believe that as a fundamental proposition of human affairs. And I find it completely alien to me as an Englishman to try and think in those terms. So I sit here and think, like, well, this is just odd, isn't it? Everything seems okay here. Everything makes me feel fundamentally quite optimistic here. And I do think to a certain extent that is about, there is something Australian there of an upbeat sense of, yes, it can happen and things are generally quite nice and we probably won't be invaded and there probably won't be a bombing campaign, you know, that flying overhead. Britain doesn't have that. But then there's just the distinction in where you're at. Like, you know, your economic growth is fine. It's fairly pedestrian. We'd kill for it. Your mineral wealth, we'd kill for it. Really quite fundamentally, I'd say the success of some of those labour market reforms from your Prime Minister, really quite impressive. There isn't this sense of fundamental decline. There is also, I'd say, at least from the conversations I've had in fairly disparate parts of your society, I was talking to one guy who was working in sort of criminal psychology, I was talking to someone else who was working in children's services. I'm not saying that they were acting like it was utopia, but they were saying like, we mostly feel that there are effective systems being deployed in these areas and that we can make ourselves useful within them. You don't hear any of this really in Britain anymore. What you get is a narrative of perpetual decline. None of the programs are working. There's no money for any of these programs. The political leadership isn't there for us. The economy is dead. Productivity hasn't improved. I know you have that same problem as well, but I think we have it in a more pronounced way. And we've had it since 2008, not since COVID. You know, this is a long run problem for us now. So I get a really fundamental distinction there. And then, and you and I actually spoke about this personally, that great big promise, the fundamental promise, which is that your life will be better than the life of your parents. You know, that seems like it is fraying here, but persists. Whereas in Britain, that promise is dead. And that is, like, politically, there's probably no more important sentence that you could say.
Is there, though, I wonder, shared between the two countries, a growing sense that change is so hard? I don't get it myself. I mean, we have a prime minister who has the biggest majority a Labour prime minister has ever had. The opposition is a rabble. We should at this point be addressing the fundamental changes that are required in the country. Now, we may be. It may all be happening quietly behind the scenes. And, you know, it may all may emerge with the budget, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is this sense in politics in Australia over the last 20, 30 years that change is becoming harder and harder. Do Britons have any notion that there can be change or are they just resigned to it?
They're pretty resigned now. They're pretty resigned. I mean, changes happen, but it's all disaster. It's like Brexit is a huge change, right? But for what?
Well, you know, yes.
Big change. What did he do it for? Can't really articulate it. What has it achieved? Absolutely nothing. Where are we now? In a worse position than we were. So change happens. It's just always in the wrong direction. And then generally speaking, you get this view sort of like a bunch of sort of people on the reactionary right who will use power as if, you know, they'd had it since they were 2 years old. And yet have no ability to plan for what they're even describe what they actually want to achieve, let alone how they're going to do it. So they mess everything up. And then people on the left who act like power is something that they never could truly deserve, no matter how big their majority or anything. Mm. So this is obviously like something that you're very used to in this country as well. I suspect that, I mean, like a lot of the tendency there, this approach of incrementalism that you start seeing seeping over on the left is just a fundamental nervousness when you assume, and I do think this is an assumption in the political classes of both countries, that the population is fundamentally right-wing. the natural instinct of the country is conservative. So you're always living on borrowed time as a progressive. You know, there's always sort of the, can we sneak it past them? You know, can we do this little bit here, this little bit there? And even when you go back to the sort of history of, you know, big left-wing achievements or liberal achievements in Britain, the creation of the NHS, liberalizing the laws on abortion, it's always sort of sold with this narrative, oh, we just kind of slipped it through. You know, we just about managed to do it, and then the right took over again, but they couldn't destroy it.
Yeah, yeah. But at least it gets through.
Exactly. You
know, yeah. Change at least gets through. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and Ian Dunt and I are just essentially talking about the problems of the world, or his world, the United Kingdom, which, if, for those who have forgotten about it, is a collection of islands in the Northern Hemisphere, which shares our language, and pays remarkable attention to what we do in this country, don't they, Ian? I mean, Britain has its eyes on Australia. We set the template for progress, change, and civilized life.
If Nick Cave says it, Britain will pay close attention. if another Australian says it, they'll pay considerably less.
Yes, that may well be so. Now, look, we were going on Saturday, the Saturday just passed, to be addressing at the Adelaide Writers' Festival the state of the world. I was chairing this session, of course, because I have no views of my own on the state of the world.
Quite right.
But the panel was to be Ian Dunt, present with me now in the studio, the Moroccan-American writer Leila Lalami, and the distinguished Russian-American journalist and author M. Gessen. We were going to be there. Why aren't we there, Ian?
Because that festival imploded in a series of baseless recriminations and unforced errors, which, look, was problematic, and I accept that there are, you know, broader points there, but on the other hand, did result in me basically having a sort of paid-for holiday around Australia. So I just think, you know, every cloud has a silver lining.
They were going to fly you to Australia for the Adelaide Writers' Festival. The Adelaide Writers' Festival collapses, and they still fly you to Australia.
Well, there's a
This is a mark of regard, Ian.
I think everyone got the same level of regard, which is essentially that once you've sort of imploded your own festival, you still just have all of these contractual obligations that you've entered into that you know sort of have to continue with. So I imagine there's been an awful lot of, I mean, like, we shouldn't under, it's one of those things, it's a news story while it's a news story. It was a free speech debate. They tried to get rid of a Palestinian author. They couldn't really specify on the basis upon which they were doing so. It was clearly just an appalling way to behave. They had a boycott from many of the writers who were going to attend. The festival collapsed in on itself, and hopefully lessons were learned, although one should never presume too much too quickly about how people do learn lessons. The logistics of that, you know, the news story moves on, but to undo some, to try and put, dismantle something on that scale is actually like a very, very difficult operation. I'm kind of full of sympathy for the people who've been involved in doing it.
Indeed, indeed. What's the situation with British literary festivals? Are rows of this kind happening in Britain? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Is Hay on Wye going to implode because an Arab writer is programmed?
Yeah, well, I mean, quite similar. I mean, there was a, on Hay, it was whether one of the funds that provides some of the funding has some sort of involvement in something that could have helped, you know, Israeli arms. I mean, just sort of think, like, really, on that basis, are we really just going to undo a major literary festival where people are going to be discussing these issues? Sort of think, like, there's this real push towards a form of puritanism in what are, and let's face it, demographically, like, progressive circles. That's generally speaking the kind of politics that you get at, you know, literary festivals and events like that. And that puritanism tends to just close us all down. It shuts us all up, and it prevents the conversations from happening. Whereas, meanwhile, on these outer rims of the right, you just say whatever you want. You know, it doesn't matter just how pernicious.
Yes, you can be as appalling as you like. And it's, you know, standing ovation. You know, that's free speech, by the way, Ian. It's not free speech on the left when you get up and say, you know, the people of Gaza are having a horrible time. Mm. That's politics.
Well, exactly.
Yes, that's politics. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, free speech.
It's not even that. It's like on the right at the moment, certainly in Britain and certainly in the US, although I think you have a better lid on it for the time being at least, it's almost like you succeed not despite saying the most objectionable and hateful things, but because you say them. Now, that is a way to have a career. And actually, you're considered, you know, you stimulate the response. Some people love you for saying it. Some people hate you for saying it. But they all talk about it on social media just the same. And you actually become more likely to be invited onto BBC sofas, to sit on BBC Question Time, on Newsnight, on the flagship current affairs programmes. So now you have people, I mean, you have podcasters out there who started having conversations about the racial necessity of English identity. You have podcasters out there who started talking about, well, Rishi Sunak obviously couldn't possibly be English, despite the fact he was born in England, literally born, you know, in the same area as I was. Like, he can't possibly be because he's not white. And that kind of conversation was impossible even 3 years ago, even two. You know, you would lose your status in society. You'd be ostracized for saying it. You say that now, you could actually, in fact, that would actually kind of help you. It becomes part of the conversation, part of the narrative. It's spread on X. It eventually finds its way onto the Today programme. And eventually you're just sat there in current affairs debates expressing this point. And that is now like a live debate that takes place. In fact, that debate has gone so far that Suella Braverman, the former Conservative Home Secretary who has now become Reform, has stood up and said that she herself is not really English because of the colour of her skin, essentially eradicating her own national identity while working for a nationalist party.
Well, she is in a tricky position. I mean, she's not white and she's working for a party that doesn't like people who are not white, and she has to survive in the party. And sometimes I think you've got no human sympathy for politicians.
No, it's true. I mean, after all, it's not like she created that situation for herself now, is it?
There's a word that comes up a lot in your writing, and the word is decent.
Mm.
And what you're talking about are the kinds of statements which, until very recently, were not held to be decent.
Yeah.
Is that a kind of a forgotten aspect of politics, where we draw the line at what is decent?
Yeah, thank you so much for realising that, because I think that has to be it, right? People will occasionally come up with this idea like, can we pass a law against lying in Parliament or something? You just think, like,
oh, yes.
So like, what does that look like? Just please think through for a minute what that looks like. Who it is that comes up with that decision as to when something is a lie and when something is vague act of misrepresentation. And please don't try to imagine that there can ever be a political culture that can exist without some element of misrepresentation. It's just not a realistic, you know, approach to have. We can't rely on laws or constitutions for this kind of thing. It is about cultural standards. That's where everything lies. You know, you look at what happens in the US. Is it really the Constitution that failed when you allowed someone that tried to launch a coup to become president again? No. It's about the cultural standards. It's about the fact that half of your electorate basically said, I don't care. And I just don't care enough about universal values or liberal democracy in order to stand up against this sort of thing. And in the UK, what you see over and over again, particularly on the right, it has to be said, like, I would love to do the both sides thing and make myself sound more reasonable than I am, but the left is much better at keeping its house in order on this stuff than the right, which has radicalized at speed in the modern era. Now, and over again, what you see is someone will come out with that kind of statement, a racialized statement, the kind of thing that used to mean that your career was over, and they will tolerate it, they will accept it, they will apologize for it, they will platform it, and they will, in fact, ultimately reward it. And look at a magazine like The Spectator. You know, ostensibly, the House... You have a version of it here. I saw it in the airport the other day.
Well, indeed, we have a version of it, but, you know, it's been... The Spectator has been here forever, yes.
Mm. Well, I hope it's in a better state than the one back home, because the one back home has just become... It's just extraordinary. It's almost like there's no limit to what someone can write or, in fact, do in their personal life and still have a place in that magazine. You know, you will be able to deal with exclusively racialized anti-immigrant rhetoric and still be given space to write in that magazine, which is not something that would take place before. You look at the Daily Telegraph, which used to be, I mean, it was sort of, I found the Daily Telegraph quite charming, like a sort of old mahogany sort of table that doesn't really work properly, but as you know, you're sentimental about. Essentially, but his readership was basically like sort of retired old generals who are haunted by their sense of sexual failure. And I rather like those sorts of people.
And yes, I'm having a fit.
Reassuring kind of form of Toryism. Now, I mean, you know, they have Douglas Carswell writing for them. Douglas Carswell writes messages on X saying that all Muslims should be forced out of the country. That is a policy platform that he repeatedly states. That is his view. That includes my partner. That includes all Muslims. You just think, like, And you're just going to have them in your newspaper. Like, you have no sense of basic cultural standards. That this kind of absolute Nazi filth you're just going to put in what should be a respectable Tory newspaper. That's where the basic decency just collapses, where they're not upholding the principles. And as soon as they stop doing that, there is this cascade towards the worst possible moral outcome. And that situation is the one that we're in Britain at the moment.
David Marr here, Late Night Live, Ian Dunt. Now, Ian, in the normal course of events, we would now be calling on you to explain what's happening right now in the United Kingdom, and I really do want to do that, because Starmer and Trump and Iran, what is going on there? I mean, the most extraordinary spectacle of a United States president insulting the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Mm.
No Winston Churchill. Well, you ain't either, Mr. Trump.
I don't know how many times this can happen before they get the message that they just can't work with this guy. You know, it's not the first time that he's lashed out at Starmer. He'll do it fairly regularly. This time feels like probably the most profound. Like, this has to be a moment of reckoning now, not just for Starmer, but for the other world leaders, whether it's Macron or whether it's, you know, whether it's in NATO or the EU, to think, do you really think you can control this guy? Or do you really think you can restrain him and shepherd him away? You can't. He's just this rabid child. He would do whatever he wants anyway, and then he'll lash out at you afterwards. You know, for ages, Starmer liked to think as if it was some great success that he'd done well building a relationship with the US president. He hasn't. No one has. No one will. Because there is no relationship that he understands that isn't based on domination and submission. No, it is just based on power. Like, really primitive emperor worship, as if we'd retreated back to early human civilization. It can't work. And so Starmer has found himself in this position which will make perfect sense in his human rights barrister politician head, which is, we don't think this is a legal... You can tell that they don't think it's legal, what's happening.
The bombing of Iran.
Yeah. I mean, for the rather obvious reason that it quite patently is not legal and has no moral or strategic basis. So they said, well, you can't use our bases for any, in Chagos Island bases, for instance, you know, in order to launch those raids.
Where does Britain have bases?
Island is the most pertinent in this
Which
regard.
Is where?
I mean, it's involved in a dispute with Mauritius. So that gives you an impression of like how useful it is in this kind of scenario.
Right.
And so you find yourself saying, well, we can't use it for that. But we do think legally you could probably use it for sorties against Iranian missile launches that are aimed at British interests in the rest of the Middle East, Doha or Dubai or et cetera. And so they then, and he clearly had a phone call with Donald Trump, where Donald Trump got very shouty, and then basically said, okay, you can use it for that. So logically, that does make sense, right? And morally, I think that can make sense. I understand the series of decisions that would have led you. Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, politically, where have you ended up? You've ended up, like, I was about to go, and literally, the moment that he made that decision, I was about to praise him for saying, you know what, at least he stood up to Trump and wouldn't let him use the Chagos Island. He's like, oh no, of course he has. And then, of course, on the right, he's being attacked for not being loyal enough to our American allies, even though we have no American allies and they're basically effectively a rogue state at the moment. So you've pleased absolutely no one. You domestically, in terms of left and right, you haven't pleased Washington. You haven't pleased anyone. And that pretty much is a very good definition for how Keir Starmer likes to govern.
Has he at least become respected in Europe?
Yes, I think so, to a certain extent. They certainly think they can do business with him. I mean, obviously, he's an improvement on any of the people that came before, you know, for the last decade. But that's an extremely low bar for him to have to hurdle over. So he has. He wants to move closer to Europe. The trouble is, he just doesn't have the bravery to come up with concrete proposals. So it's just very vague and mercurial. Yes, eventually after a year of work, they'll say something like, oh, I think we might want some kind of regulatory alignment on, you know, phytosanitary goods. We want to be involved in defence, but not so closely involved, you know, that it would involve some kind of... And you just think, like, okay, here we are. You know, you just don't... Unless you're willing to just state, this is the concrete things that we are doing, it's what we want, it's the outcome we're pursuing, it's very hard for people to deal with you. And more broadly, the British-European relationship can't be properly repaired on vibes alone. It has to be repaired on falsifiable, testable propositions of what you want to achieve. Here is the landing zone that we want. Here's what we want the future relationship to look like. If it's just vibes based, the Europeans have no reason to trust us and no reason to think that anything they do agree to won't be reversed when the next government takes over.
Is there in Britain at least a move to re-enter the single market?
Weirdly, at the moment, there's more of a push for the customs union, which is sort of, I mean, it's all much of a muchness, really. But the customs union doesn't involve freedom of movement. That's the big distinction.
And you've written this several times, that what Britain could fix up most of its problems with Europe if it would just allow freedom of movement.
Yeah, exactly. That's what this is all about. It's all, just like everything else, an immigration debate. You know? And the thing is, what did you see immediately after they got rid of freedom of movement after Brexit? A huge surge in immigration from the rest of the world. And in what kind of jobs were those people going into? They were going into basically social care, looking after elderly Brits, because we need those people and we're not willing to pay the money to have other people do it. And most Brits aren't willing to do that work either. So you can end it. This is the thing about having just a rational conversation about immigration. You can end it here, but if you still have need domestically, you're going to find it somewhere else. So now we've ended it there. Now we've cut immigration right down to the bone. And very soon, and if I'm wrong about this, I'll eat my shoes, you'll start having debates about my gran was left, you know, sat on the floor of, you know, of her living room for 3 days. No one came to help her.
In a puddle of urine.
Exactly, exactly. Those stories will start taking off and people will think like, oh, and what we're already seeing in the debate, we saw it in the spring statement yesterday, was that by cutting immigration, you're cutting growth projections. That means you're cutting the fiscal headroom that the Chancellor has available for her fiscal rules, which means that eventually she starts to have to raise taxes or at least start a conversation about raising taxes or cutting public services. And the government's going to think, oh, do I really want to go into the next election having to face tax rises or cuts to public services? No. So again, for all these different reasons, they will start very quietly without saying anything about it, raising the level of immigration. And then eventually there'll be another scandal about having the levels gone too high. And at no point will they have the basic confidence to just have an honest conversation with the public about this issue. And until progressives are willing to have that conversation, we will keep on losing on it.
Talking about honest conversations, Ian, can we have an honest conversation about the fate of the monarchy? Okay. In the shadow, in the great fat grey shadow of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Are they done for?
How dare you talk about him in such ways? They are not. There's going to be a lot of talk about that at the moment. There is pretty much every time we see one of these eventualities. But in Britain, you're not going to get anywhere on it. You're just not. And I mean, look. If they open up some police file and they find extensive details of the king himself, you know, having conversations with Andrew on this and that, then we might see a change. Although even then, I'd be surprised if there was any kind of movement.
He'd just abdicate, wouldn't he? And popular young William.
And we get William
over.
In there who has not, you know, hidden his absolute disdain for Andrew at any point.
Uncle Andrew.
Uncle Andy. It won't change. And one of the reasons it won't change is because people don't want it to. Like, it's not popular on the right, the idea of change, and it's not popular on the left. Of course, there is that part of the sort of like the intelligent left. In other words, you know, basically people that live in North London, the entirety of my social circle.
Yes. Of which you are a leader, I presume.
No, I've been ostracized and thrown out of that tribe a long time ago.
All right.
Partly for views, you know, like this. So like you sort of get, you know, you're chatting in a wine bar, you're a left winger. In that place, is there any chance that they're a monarchist? And the answer is no. They will always sort of be pro, you know, Republican, every single time. But there's just not enough left-wingers that feel that way. There aren't. When you look at the way that people vote, the actual voters rather than party members, for instance, that's not what you're going to hear. What you're going to hear is they quite like the monarchy. And I think they like the monarchy for very sensible reasons. It's not the doffing of the cap. It's that they instinctively know you really want that head of state position to be non-political. You just don't want it to start like the nightmare scenario is you'd reform and then you'd be like, okay, so what happens now? We're going to have an election and it's going to be Nigel Farage versus Gina Miller or, you know, Zach Polanski, yes, yes. You know, for who's going to be the head of state. And you just think, no one wants that. Even those guys on the right and the left don't want it. Nobody wants it. And because they don't want it, and because there is no really solid answer to what you would replace it with, you just don't see any real push to change it.
You could be talking about Australia there, Ian.
Well, I know that's exactly what happened in the referendum, right? Mm. I remember during Brexit, we'd look back on that Australian referendum on the monarchy and think, very interesting what happens when you start asking for what the replacement will be.
Yes. Right?
What would the Brexit result have been like if you had to say, not just, yeah, we want out the EU, but this is the alternate model that we're proposing. What if they had to outline that the scenario we're in right now, is this is your alternate model? Would they have succeeded then? Absolutely not. Forcing people in referendums to grapple with operational reality is quite a telling thing to do, I think.
I'm wondering whether Britain could take just a first step in this direction by getting rid of an upper house which is populated by nobles. I thought the French Revolution had done for such an arrangement, but it survives.
I'm quite pro the House of Lords as well, I'm sorry to tell you.
Give us your reasons. You have about a minute. Give us your reasons, Dunk.
There is no expertise anywhere in the British political system. Our entire system, from the civil service to the MPs to the ministers, are generalist amateurs. They know nothing about anything. They fail. They write policy they can't comprehend. It fails. There are no consequences to them whatsoever. But in the House of Lords, because it's not elected, you have people that are non-party political, the crossbench peers, put there because of their accomplishments in a particular area of the economy. They could be scientists, they could be business people, they could be from defence, they could be from volunteering, and they especially could be from law, and they get it. You put something down on social security and you will see some very impressive people go to work. They'll take a scalpel to it. And there you see actual expertise, hard specialist knowledge, and it's pretty much the only place in the British system where you do see that. So although I get the moral arguments against it, seeing the level of amateurishness everywhere in Westminster, the fact that there's one part of it that has some specialist scrutiny capacity, that's the one bit I'd want to preserve rather than get rid of.
But doesn't Britain have this extraordinarily skilled civil service?
No, the civil service is absolutely hopeless. There was an old sort of, we've managed to convince everyone that we do it for the same reason that everyone thinks we have a good security services simply because of James Bond, but we absolutely don't. They're largely hopeless as well. I mean, civil service, it will reward you financially and in terms of status by how quickly you move through jobs. So if you go from Home Office to the Foreign Office to doing universal credit to negotiating Brexit to working on HS2, oh, you're a high flyer. You spend 18 months in each job. You know absolutely nothing about anything. You're just utterly ignorant about the place that you work. If you go into the hard engine room jobs that a country needs, for instance, like rail contract negotiation, and you stay there for 30 years and you learn everything about it and you can operate in a way that lets you go toe-to-toe with private interests, you'll be penalised. There is no way of financially or socially rewarding that individual in the civil service. So what we have incentivised and created is a civil service full of generalized amateurs who know nothing and penalizing anyone that has any level of expertise.
For this cheerful portrait of the United Kingdom, it's a strange business, you know, Ian. So many Australians like me have this notion that I'm not a foreigner in Britain. I can be a stranger, but I'm not a foreigner.
Quite right.
And it's for a surprisingly large number of Australians, and therefore we have this profound curiosity about what's going on behind our backs in the United Kingdom, for which, Ian, we are grateful to you here on Late Night Live. Thanks for turning up in person for once. Do it again.
It's been a real pleasure being here, as has the last 8 years. Thank you.
I've been talking to Ian Dunt, who is now in person, going to tell us what he actually does, apart from appearing on Late Night Live. You?
Hello, I am Ian Dunt. I'm a columnist with the Eye newspaper, a co-host on the Origin Story podcast, and the UK contributor for Late Night Live.
Fabulous. Fabulous. And that's the show. On our next, economist and politician barely begins to describe the many roles Yanis Varoufakis plays in his crowded life. Yanis is joining us on the show to talk politics, economy, war, and being charged in Greece the other day for taking an ecstasy pill 36 years ago in Australia. Can the jails of Greece hope to contain the guilty? Until then.